Hello, this is Earl Fontanelle, and you're listening to The Schwepp. Today we're speaking with Turaj Daryaei, who is chair in Persian Studies and Culture in the History Department at the University of California, Irvine, and a man who knows a thing or two about Zoroastrianism in late antiquity. Turaj, thank you so much for coming on The Schwepp.
It's my pleasure, Earl. Thank you for the invitation.
Doctor, before we get into the Sasanian religious scene, I just wanted to ask if you can help, as a specialist, if you can help me straighten out a couple terms. We've got these two terms, Zoroastrianism and Mazdaism.
I think Zoroastrianism in general today is the term that is used in relevance to Christianity in relation to Christ. And Mohammedanism, as it used to be called, the religion of Islam in relation to its prophet Muhammad. So that is what we find. Now, Mazdaism is, I think, a term of the worship of Ahura Mazda, the super deity in the Zoroastrian religious system that develops through time. And so these terms can be used interchangeably. In antiquity, we both have evidence of people calling themselves Zarathustrish, Zoroastrian, as well as Mazda Yasna, worshipper of
right.
Mazda. So they could be interchanged, but I think when we get to late antiquity, we can really go with the system of Zoroastrian religious.
Okay. Religion. Now then, let us move to late antiquity. The 7th century, the House of Sasan. So we have given an introduction to some of the geopolitics in late antiquity, and one of the overarching stories of that is the conflict between the late Roman Empire and the Sasanian Empire. And both empires at the time are undergoing radical religious change, right? Not only among the people on the ground, but in governmental sort of circles. Moves toward creating religious ideology of this intertwining ideology and the state in new ways. So I wonder if you could give us a kind of very brief, or as brief as possible, it doesn't have to be very brief, but let's say as brief as possible to do the job, summary of the state of Zoroastrianism under the Sasanians.
Yes. In the 3rd century, when Ardashir, the founder of the Sasanian Empire, creates this notion of Iran Shah, the land of the Iranians. He's very specific on his coinage and inscription that he is a Mazda worshiper. And so the signal is sent out. This is clearly on the coinage meant for all to see. It is different from the preceding Arsacid period, or even you might say the ancient Persian Achaemenid Empire. Here, the state is prophesizing that they are followers of Ahura Mazda and its religious tradition. Now, we find that Ardashir himself and the family are caretakers of a fire temple dedicated to Lady Anahita, which is another Zoroastrian deity. So we already are seeing a system that while Ahura Mazda may be the head of this pantheon, you have other important deities that people are, they're like saints. So they're their patron saints, you might think of it in the Christian world. And soon enough, in the Talmudic sources and other evidence suggests that there is a hindering of other religious movements or proselytizations, and Zoroastrianism is being established as a religious system. Now, this, by the 4th and 5th century, has to change and the view of the empire vis-a-vis other religious communities. And by the 7th century, which you mentioned, I think while Zoroastrianism and Mazdaism is part of this ethnic cultural empire, Christianity is the other important player. And there's an eye to that, and I can explain why.
Let's talk about Christianity. Well, let's talk about the other important player. You've also alluded to the sizable Jewish community in Babylonia. So before moving on to kind of what this religion was like a bit more. What are the other key movements? We have Christians, and they are not the same kind of Christians for the most part as you find in the Roman Empire, right? They're so-called Nestorians, I think. That's Church right. of the East.
Nestorians, yes. And the scenario is, at least until the 4th century, Christianity is much more of a safe haven on the Sasanian realm territory than what is happening in Rome, yeah. obviously, until Theodosius, probably, if not earlier. And these Christians are Aramaic-speaking, Syriac-speaking Christians, dominant even today. At least we find their residual in northwestern Iran, in Turkey, and in Syria. Their liturgy is in Syriac, but as they become stronger and the state of the Sasanian Empire allows them to thrive, we find this bilingualism. So the earliest Persian or Middle Persian liturgy are the Psalms, which are in Middle Persian, but there are clear signs that they were translated by someone who was bilingual and was Syriac speaking.
Right.
And it's them who make this Christian Persian religion thrive.
Okay. And then the Jews, I think we have covered roughly in the podcast what's going on. There was a big migration of Jews to the area known as Babylonia after the destruction of the temple, especially. And they have been hard at work, right? And that is actually the area out of which what we know as rabbinic Judaism will, in the course of many, many, many centuries, develop into a recognizable thing. How are the Jews doing under the Sasanians? As you mentioned, like they're at least in an uneasy relationship from time to time with the ruling power.
While initially there is a shock and that things have changed from the Arsacid period or the Parthian period to the Sasanians, we find that very soon the religious group that works most closely and follows the Sasanian kings, and sometimes we're told that they intermarry with them, are the Jews. And the Jews are shown as, even in rabbinic literature, being present at the court. And some of the practices are now that people who work on the Talmud and Zoroastrianism show that there's close affinity in dress, in mannerism, in laws, and so on. So this seems, the Magi and the rabbis seems to have had a long history of yeah. interaction. And in the late antiquity, obviously, that is there as well. At least, perhaps in the Jewish hierarchy, those who are having powers and positions. So all in all, we don't hear of Jewish persecutions or pogroms, really, during the Sasanian period.
Yeah, it's a much nicer place to be for a Jew than, for example, Constantinople under Justinian, where it's just impossible to live, basically. I mean, just the state of absolute persecution. Thank you. So that's some background out of the way. Now, there's more religious groups afoot in the Persian realm, which yes. I want to talk to you about. But before we do that, first of all, what are our sources? Because one of the things that's always puzzled me, and maybe you can give me some light on this, is that from this period in Rome, let's say late antiquity generally, we don't have nearly as much literary evidence as we'd like, but we have a lot of literary evidence. Now, if we turn toward the Persian side, there's this language, Middle Persian, as it's known, has an alphabet. We know they could write stuff. We know that they were sometimes translating Greek works into Middle Persian. We know that there's Middle Persian everywhere. But our sources are very slender on the ground, from what I've been able to understand. When people want to look at, for example, dynastic history of the Persian kings, they look to the Shahnameh. They don't look to any native Persian source. So what's going on there? Why are our sources in such a terrible state?
Sure. I have a couple of reasons for this, but you're absolutely right. There is no Ammianus Marcellinus on the Sasanian side. There is no Herodian for the Sasanian side. What you see in the third century, especially, are long inscriptions. And it's these inscriptions, the Res Gestae of the King of Kings, that tells us about history, the way they think of the past and themselves and the Romans, and what they've been able to achieve, and some local or internal dynastic issues. Now, we know the Sassanians had a royal chronicle in the 6th century. And this is attested in Armenian sources. The Shahnameh, which is a Persian recension in some form of that royal chronicle, in classical Persian, suggests that. But other sources also on the Roman side, they tell us there's a royal chronicle. That royal chronicle, I think, along many of the Middle Persian texts and sources, when the Muslims come in the 7th century and in the 8th century, Arabic becomes the language of chancery, the language of government. All of these that are useful are translated into Arabic. So when you see tens of different chronicles of kings of Persia, as it's called, where they're listed their feats, obviously, it's not just from memory, but what has happened is everything has been translated that is useful into Arabic, because Arabic is the lingua franca. As English, for example, is today the language. You might be bilingual, but you translate these for posterity. And that's what happens. Tabari is really looking at all the sources, looking back to an empire that had its sources, but it's not there anymore. Because no one is speaking Middle Persian in that way anymore. The Persian language itself has developed into classical Persian, and the script of choice becomes the Arabic script.
Right, which it still is to this day. So there's a process of sort of sucking out whatever the Arab conquerors think is useful and good and potentially fun to read, translating it,
yes,
and then just the rest gets chucked, basically.
Well, we have some Zoroastrian texts. We have, you know, we have a couple of, like, it's 100 maybe texts, 100 and some, but they're some very small, some very large, but they are mainly religious matters.
Right.
And it's clear because the Zoroastrian priests, the Magi, were concerned with that. They kept what they could and they kept copying. It's religious matters.
Yeah. So let's talk about Zoroastrians. And before we talk about, like, a picture of the Zoroastrian religion, the question of sources again. But I promise this is the last time. I don't promise, but I think it's the last time. Because one of the things you read as a non-specialist is that Zoroastrianism, incredibly ancient religion. Zoroaster, most people think he was a real person, but no one knows how to date this prophetic figure. Way back, though. We're talking Bronze Age. We're talking millennia BCE. Very, very ancient figure, potentially. But the sources, the religious writings of Zoroastrianism are late, right? In written down form. So there's one of these periods that drive textual historians absolutely crazy, which is the period of oral tradition.
Yes, exactly.
What's the picture here? Yes. What are the basic Zoroastrian texts? And when are they written down as far as we can tell?
The collection of hymns of the Zoroastrian tradition, which is called the Avesta, its written form suggests to have been done in the 4th century, probably during the rule of Shapur II.
Right.
And codified by the time of Khosrow I, the great Sasanian king in the 6th century. Now, those who deal with linguistics, poetics, suggest that this Avesta is multi-layered. It has very old hymns called the Gathas, the songs, cognate with Sanskrit Gita, like the Bhagavad Gita. Mm-hmm. The songs attributed to Zoroaster, these 17 hymns, are more of a personal dialogue. And one of my colleagues told me once, and I really liked the way he explained this, it's like an orchestra. Zoroaster is conducting an orchestra, Ahura Mazda is there, but his aspects, the Amishastandas, the immortal, the boundless immortals, who are the aspects of Ahura Mazda on the other side. And there's this not a dialogue. It is like more than a dialogue. So suddenly Zoroaster asks Ahura Mazda, oh, why have you created the sky and the earth? And then suddenly an aspect of Ahura Mazda comes out and explains it. So there's that type of a dialogue. Linguistically, it is the closest thing to the Vedas, the ancient Sanskrit writings. And it's based on this that we tend to date these somewhere between 1400 and 1000 BCE or 900 BCE. So it's a linguistic connection, vocabulary, very close. And then you have a series of yashts in the Avesta. These are hymns dedicated to various deities, to 30 of them. And there, interestingly, linguistically is a little bit later. It shows that, that it's not the old Avestan. And there you find hymns to, the longest one is to the god Mithra, who seems to have been quite important in the Iranian world. It's an Indo-Iranian deity of oath and contract, which discusses the aspects of Mithra. And then there are yash, such as the Zamyad yash, the yash to the earth, which in fact is an early oral royal chronicle of the bygone kings, which doesn't give you exactly the location, but we know it's of this ancient Iranian world. Now, between these two, actually, we have a prose text called the Yasna Haptang Haiti, the seven yasnas. They're in the prose, and they seem to be post-Zoroaster writings. So you might imagine a Buddhist tradition where the sayings of the Buddha is put together, and then there's a Sangha, and the Sangha and his followers are producing texts. And I think the last part of the Avesta is the Videvdad, the book of anti-demonic law, which is quite fascinating. It is really a repository of ancient Iranian or Zoroastrian geography. The first chapter recounts all the 17 lands that they had a purview of. And then the second chapter is the story of Yima, the primordial man who creates this enclosure before the great winter. And here I think you can see some rabbi-magi interaction, if one was to think about it. And then there are a whole series of laws on behavior, and especially, just like Judaism, attention to purity. The idea of purity and pollution drives this Videvdad. And we see this, that there are commentaries made at the same time as the Talmud is being written, that the Zoroastrians are writing commentaries on the purity and pollution laws, because that's what is important for the society and the Magi.
Hmm. Thank you. That's a wonderful summary. So, so many fascinating pieces here. The comparison with Judaism, I think, is a really helpful one in the sense that, on the one hand, it's correct to say that the scriptures of the religion are really, really, really ancient. On the other hand, you can see layers, and the process of addition and redaction goes on until potentially the period we know as late antiquity. Certainly the commentary tradition is still going on. So it's this multi-layered, quite sprawling, big body of texts, which originally were not written at all. They were delivered orally by Zoroaster and then presumably delivered, or, you know, passed on orally for centuries. Now, people talk about the strong dualism of Zoroastrianism as its crucial characteristic, its signature move, right? There's the monotheisms, and then there's dualist Zoroastrianism. But I've also seen scholars say, Zoroastrianism is actually a monotheism. It just has this emphasis on a kind of dual thing going on. What's your take on that question, if you think it's an interesting question?
Sure, yes. It's something really important for Zoroastrians today. But again, that's it's a little bit of a historiographical issue. I see Zoroastrianism as both monotheistic, dualistic, but also polytheistic.
Right.
How does that work? Ahura Mazda is the supreme deity. So if you're saying that these people worship the most important deity for them is Ahura Mazda. But there are a host of other Yazatas, those that are worthy of being worshipped. So they're important as well. So it's not just one deity. And then when we call about dualism in the Gathas of Zarathustra, we don't really have that dualism of deities against each other. Ahura Mazda is the supreme lord. There's nothing, there's not even an evil entity equal to it. What happens is then beside Ahura Mazda, there's the evil spirit, Angra Mainu or Ahriman, and the good spirit. Okay? And it's this dualism that really in the Sasanian Empire has developed in something a little bit different, where Ahura Mazda and Ahriman have become almost on par fighting each other. And that's that dualism that gathers attention to authors and people from various parts of this dualistic view. But I think in the initial phase, it's Mazda. It's that's above all.
So again, if we're thinking about in these early days, the early Near East, like say 7th century BCE, and we want to talk about rabbis and magi chatting, you've got a creator deity who is the soul. First of all, you have a prophetic figure who's received wisdom from the creator deity. He's laying it on the people saying, this is the deal. There's one God. He is supreme. He created the heavens and the earth. Ritual purity is going to become really important. How much ritual purity material do we find in the early material?
Very little. It's more of practices, different ways of practices that is worn. It's, as you've said, there's this message. There's a dialogue to get explanation better by Mazda to Zoroaster. And Zoroaster says, you know, there are these two ways. You choose. But it's very interesting. It says, at the end of time, and there's an end of time, as it's
worn. And there's an end of time. And there's a judgment. There's a postmortem judgment. This is all... Like, this is all stuff that people associate very much with, like, Second Temple Judaism. Mm-hmm. But it's all there first in Zoroastrianism.
It's about, around 1000 BC. It says, you know, you're going to either end up in what later scholars in Sasanian period called House of Stench. That is the hell.
Yeah.
It's dark, it's stinky, and it's cold. Okay? Mm. Or you end up in the House of Songs, where there's beautiful song. There's the sun, and everything is fragrant. This is a dualism that we are now would say exists in the early period.
Mm. Yes, thank you. This is all kind of like Zoroastrianism 101.
Mm-hmm.
But that being said, it's really important, I think, to understand at least a little bit what we can say about our earliest revelation and development of this religion versus what we know about it in late antiquity. Because I would argue that late antiquity, at least for the purposes of our podcast, is where Zoroastrianism is going to come onto the stage of Western esotericism. Mm. Because when the Muslims invade, Zoroastrianism is not something that can anymore be regarded as a kind of foreign other. It's now going to be an internal other. Or in the cases of some Muslims, like Sufi mystics, for example, it's going to become part of a longer wisdom lineage that's not even other at all. It's all gets thrown into the mix, at least on the level of construction of identity. I'm thinking of Suhravardi, for example, who's like, you know, for him, Zoroastrianism or Zoroastrian tradition is part of the wisdom lineage that he's drawing on.
Yes.
Now, before we get to that, we've got a little picture of this religion, and we have two big other main religious communities, Christians and Jews. Now, there's two kind of splinter, offshoot new religious movements that occur in late antiquity in the Persian realm that are really interesting. One is Manichaeism, which we've talked about on the podcast. It's absolutely essential to understand Manichaeism as much as we can if you want to study Western esotericism. But before we talk about Manichaeism, let's talk a little bit about Mazdakism, which we've never spoken about in the podcast. And it's a very interesting phenomenon. Worth discussing, right?
Yes, absolutely. Mazdak, who seems to have been a Zoroastrian priest in the 5th century, in effect, I believe, is trying to reform Zoroastrian law in order to appease the difficulty that the Zoroastrian community in the Sasanian Empire and the empire itself is facing. So these are reforms in terms of marriage laws, its property laws, and it's interesting that, of course, for the traditional Zoroastrian priests, this is just over the top. So reforming marriage law to them means that he's at talking about sharing of women. Reforming property laws for them, it means that this guy is a proto-communist. He says we should share property. And so this is, of course, most of our views or information is from these antagonist sources. So that is what we are faced with. But he seems to have had his own, a little bit of a different cosmological view. And he seems to be a religious reformer. He seems to be, although it's too early, and I don't know if this is an apt example, like a Martin Luther, if I was going to say.
I'm almost thinking, like, forget about Martin Luther. He's like one of the Münster Anabaptists, okay, or the radical, mm-hmm, like, levelers of the 17th century. He's like, you know, like, this feels like peasant revolt, mm-hmm, to me. Like, he's getting a kind of a class-based, power-based together, and he's going to try to overthrow the ruling classes, right?
Yes.
Redistribute the land. So that's a big problem for the Sasanians, but they managed to deal with it in the time-honored fashion of killing everybody. Or have I got that wrong?
So I think the king needs to make structural change. So actually, I think they use Mazdak and the masses to actually level the power of the nobility. And once that is done, yes, once now they've destroyed their own, the people who don't let them make reforms, because there's structural reforms needed. Now you distribute land among lower nobility and other people, and you make changes. Now you take care of the problem, because, of course, Mazdak is important. So I think the Shahnameh of Ferdowsi, the Persian Book of Kings and Epic, most beautifully describes this end of Mazdak and the Mazdakites, where King Khosrow invites him to a garden and says, I want to show you a garden. And when they enter, they see all of these people head down into the earth and feet up. And Khosrow tells Mazdak, see what you have sown. And this is what you will get. And then he is killed.
This is like sort of the night of the long knives, mm-hmm, of the Sasanian regime, mm-hmm, right? I mean, this is a very irresponsible historical comparison. No, that's just what it reminds me of.
It's, you know, it's very much... when we think of this theory of the gardening state, the state is there to keep its garden clean, and the king is in charge. Mm-hmm. When he sees grass, mm-hmm, growing where it's not supposed to, I'm just saying, this is the king acts as a gardener.
Yeah. Now, the relevance of the Mazdak incident to the history of Westness or terracism, you could argue there really isn't that much. But to me, that's just a fascinating phenomenon in late antique Persian society that it would be a pity to just completely skip over. Mm. Now, what we can't skip over is Manichaeism. And we've talked about Manichaeism in the podcast already with Jason Badoun.
Fantastic. He is the person.
He's the man. One thing he didn't talk about, though, very much, is the context of Mani within Sasanian politics, society, and indeed Zoroastrian religion. You know, there's a very strong, what you might call, dualist strand in Manichaeism, very strong, but there is in late antique Judaism and late antique Christianity as well. It's like everyone is kind of getting quite dualist in this period. Mm-hmm. If we think of dualism as a kind of tendency or approach to the world rather than a like official theological position, right? It's more just like, there's evil, it's around, we have to deal with evil, it's really important. That's very much across the board in late antique religions, it seems to me. Now, tell me about Mani's relationship with the Sasanian state, because he goes to the top, sure, right? He's this sort of prophetic figure, and he's like, I've got a new revelation, I'm going to take it to the people who matter.
I'm going to say something I'm going to say something that's maybe preposterous, but my view of Mani within the context of Iranian history and Iranian religion, I see Manichaeans as sort of early proto-Sufis, mystics of the Iranian world. That is, you have this, I don't want to compare maybe to, let's say, Rumi's mentor, but you have this person who has received, again, revelation in many languages, and is interesting, and it piques the interest of the king. What Jason Baduna, in fact, has done recently with the Coptic material, it suggests that he's there, king is interested, the court is interested, they're asking questions, they say, okay, this is really interesting. It sounds like Zoroastrianism, but it's really put in a poetic form, sometimes esoteric form. And the more esoteric, I think, Manichaean is more of interest. It piques people's interest. Go ahead. You could go around and do your thing until this Zoroastrian structure is building itself and it has a knee-jerk reaction to it in the form of a priest in the 3rd century, Kerdir, the only one who left us inscriptions as a Zoroastrian priest, yeah. Telling us what he did. And even the Manichaean sources say that he had a hand in the fall of Mani. But I see these people providing a dualistic view of the world, but in a pessimistic world, right? This fleeting world. There's nothing good in this world. You should fast. You should, be together and work and hope for salvation in the form of release of your spirit and becoming one with the Lord.
Now, this figure, Kirdir, is very interesting.
Yes.
Because, as you say, he's a priest. And he's the only priest whose voice we really hear very clearly from antiquity. And therefore, our evidence would seem to be, just based on that piece of data, like his contribution, it can trick you into thinking that the Sasanian state is undergoing something very analogous to the Roman state in this period, which is the formation of a kind of state religion. And we know from the podcast and we know from many historical sources that this takes place in Rome, the transition from Constantine's initial sort of opening the gates to imperial Christianity to the formation of something like a state religion under, say, Theodosius, is a very long and very slow process. And it doesn't really become what you'd call, what we would, looking back through the Middle Ages, what we would think of as like a state Christianity until Justinian, really. That's when it's like, okay, we recognize this. This is the sort of thing you see in the Middle Ages in Christendom. Do we think something analogous is happening in Sasania or not? Or do we not know enough to say?
We don't know enough. It's an interesting thought. But what is clear is, as the Manichaeans are creating scriptures and handing it down everywhere, and as Christianity has now its scripture codified, almost the same time, the Zoroastrians have to react to these proselytizing religions that are, gravitating. They have a message. They have a book. And so they have to work towards a book, and they put out their messages and make sure that these people don't run over the empire. After all, it's a Mazda worshiping king and so on. And I think Kerdir is an excellent candidate as he becomes the judge of the empire. So that already tells us. During the rule of Bahram II in the 3rd century, he has become the judge of empire. To put a magi in charge of legal matters, that, I think, signals that the state is looking at Mazdaism, as Zoroastrianism, as a state religion. So if it's a state religion, it should have some structures. So I think that's developing a little bit earlier.
Okay, so the last big question I wanted to ask you about is about the coming of Islam. Now, something I think probably no one could have anticipated happens. I don't think anyone thinks that the empire is just going to be conquered and taken over by a completely, like, a different people, a different language, a different religion. But that is what happens in a way that doesn't happen in Rome. Rome gets, loses most of its territory and suffers major, major defeats. And Constantinople is almost captured quite a few times, but it never quite happens until the 15th century. What can we say in the very broad strokes about the relationship with Islam going forward between Islam and Zoroastrianism. Now, Zoroastrianism is no longer the state religion, obviously, but it's still a religion in Iran. So what happens next?
What happens is, I think neither the Muslims know what to think of the Zoroastrians, because they're not Abrahamic. It's clear if you're Christian or Jewish, you're part of the people of the book. But there's this huge amount of people that you've conquered. And you just cannot say all of you are heathens and, you know, finish. So somehow legalistically, they're found to be people of the book. Okay, they have a book. But, you know, it's wholly so different. But it's tolerated, at least until 1000 AD or CE. We hear of lots of fire temples. Now, I think what happens is there's a loss of state support, as there was before for it. And the Zoroastrians really see the turn. That is, Islam becomes the dominant religion. I think it coincides with Europe, that in Europe, there are estimates sometimes that by 1000 AD, the dominant religion becomes Christianity. And meanwhile, you know, there are non-Christians. And I think in the Sasanian Empire, where you have these large number of Christians, Syriac and non-Syriac, you have Mandaeans, who are still there today. I don't know if you've talked about them. There are Buddhists in the East. And the Zoroastrians eventually either convert. Some of them still remain, of course, until today. And some immigrate to China and to India. And the Mazdakites, for that matter, some of them, you know, turned to the Byzantines.
Right. So there's a long process. There is a long period of going, what is Zoroastrianism? Trying to understand it, trying to find a way to fit it in with the whole system. They figure out a way. Okay, religion of the book, great. And the Zoroastrians fall on hard times, for sure, but they don't get persecuted. However, eventually there is a big diaspora of people leaving to look for a better deal. And that's why we have so many Zoroastrians today in communities in India, in China, and I think in Toronto, if I'm not mistaken.
In Toronto, there's a major Zoroastrian. Here in Orange County, we have two or three fire temples.
Right on.
That's called that.
Yeah. So, and that's the situation today. Do you know what the situation is in modern-day Iran with Zoroastrians?
Sure. I think after the 1979 revolution, which became an Islamic revolution, where Islam became the really, it was an important part of legal tradition, but now became the Islamic law, became the law of the land, I think many left. And that's why we find the Zoroastrians all over the world. But more importantly, we should remember, it's just not the Irani Zoroastrians. There are many Parsis. There are more Indian ones who have emigrated as well. So Toronto is very much dominated as such among other places. So we have very few Zoroastrians. Of course, they believe that is their land, and they still now perform ceremonies, not only in the fire temples, but more recently in ancient sites, such as the great fire temple of the Sasanian Shiz, as after Suleiman, which Heraclius destroyed. So they're going back and they're making sacrifices. It's hugely popular religion, but the Zoroastrians, of course, quite afraid of any conversion because that would endanger them. For the Jews, of course, it's an up and down. There was ideas that there were up to 25,000 Jews before the revolution in Iran. Obviously a mistake. More recent, research and just having more than probably 100,000 Persian Jews in Los Angeles, like just that, you know, statistics really don't work in these countries. So there was a sizable Jewish community. Now, unfortunately, with what is going on today, I am not sure what will happen, but there's still synagogues. In Tehran, the capital, sometimes there were more than 100 synagogues.
Yeah.
They're still kept up to some extent. But, you know, the numbers are dwindling. Now, some Jews used to go and come back. And that is something that you hear. But you have still some Jewish community. The Mandaeans, again, who are really fascinating. They're still there. But a lot of them have moved to Texas. I've seen beautiful pictures by the river. Amazing. And they're going other places.
Yeah.
Buddhism, I don't think there's much that is left, at least northern Afghanistan, which was a hotbed of the sort of Eastern Islam. So that's the case.
Yeah. I wonder if you can say anything more specifically about the role, and this is more as a kind of appetizer for things to come in the podcast, about the role that Zoroastrianism plays in the more esoteric side of Islam.
I mean, I think from the Greeks onward, the idea that the Magi have esoteric knowledge. They can see the stars. That's what they're called, Magi. They can do, you know, they have special knowledge. And this, I think, is because of historical circumstance, by the way. Yes, they know the mantras by heart. They're trying to, of course, what they do in the Avesta, it's the idea of how the every morning what the priests do, or they used to do for 4 hours, to recite how the world was created. And what everything was put into place. And you say this and you do this and you make the sacrifice to the gods and various deities to make sure that this world survives as such, right? The sun rises, the plants grow, as well as being before the fire, making the, again, proper hymns and sacrifice, but also the ceremony and keeping people pure spiritually, but as well as physically. And I think some of these ideas certainly enters Islam. I think the idea of being mystics and Sufis, we find already the term dervish, meaning mystic, or a mendicant poor, as good that for a translation, with Mazdak, joining the Mazdakite movement. These people are appeased and given you know, some support, and they survive into Islam as dervishes. And of course, they have their own vision of the world, and you know, it's Islam, but it's not, doesn't need to be following its precepts.
Yeah. As we enter into the world of Sufism, we're going to see again and again that the image, especially in Sufi poetry, Sufi erotic poetry, the image of, you know, what does the Sufi lover who's drunk with love do? He becomes like the Christian monk. He becomes like the fire worshiper. He goes to these people it as his model for true ecstatic love of the divine. And so these figures of sort of, they're beyond the pale, they're sort of forbidden, they're others, but at the same time, they're more true to Islam than Islam in some way. You know, the figure of the dervish, the figure of the magos, makush, as infinitely desirable other who's close to God, is a figure that we shall encounter again and again in the history of Western esotericism going forward. Once again, thank you. I hope we get to speak again. And until then, stay esoteric.
Thank you.